So we're talking with Dr. Alan Bodkin, and coming up this hour, we're going to also talk with some of the people that he has treated with this after-death communication, which he induces, and then we'll get your calls coming up in the final hour with him. But we were just chatting about it just before the top of the hour, so let me ask him. Dr. Bodkin, you were describing a couple of the patients, and I just want to, which one? Sam's a great story. But there are other veterans and other types of experiences that they couldn't get over until they were able to talk with the dead through this therapy. Can you give us some other examples of that?
Well, I can give you the case, which is which was a turning point for me, where it was the first time I actually purposefully induced the experience. I was working with a patient named Gary, and he had lost a daughter a number of years prior to our session, and his daughter was severely retarded at birth. She was oxygen deprived, and her mental age never developed beyond, I think, a one or two year old. I forget, it's in the book, but and she was when she died, she was a teenager, I believe. But anyway, Gary and his wife were out at dinner one night, and on the way home, they passed an ambulance going in the opposite direction, and they soon found out that their daughter was in that ambulance, and she had suffered a severe heart attack, and her mental functioning as a result had declined even further, and she was hospitalized and put on a respirator, you know, to assist in her breathing. And but anyway, after some time, their daughter showed some signs of being able to breathe on her own. So they made the decision, the difficult decision, to take her off the respirator to see if she could make it. And the day they did, their daughter died in Gary's arms.
Of natural causes.
Yes. And when we went through this in therapy, it was very, very painful for him. He was deeply, deeply and profoundly saddened by this loss. And but anyway,
was this case similar to other cases too, where there also is not just a grief and, you know, a sense of loss, but also the trauma of guilt?
Yes.
Spun in there.
Yeah, I'm sure. Guilt for, you know, not being home when the daughter experienced the heart attack. Guilt for maybe having made the decision for taking her off the respirator, and so on. But in my approach with EMDR, I at least initially ignore that, and I go right for the profound sadness.
Well, but still, just to play with that for a second longer, guilt also often pops up in the case of these veterans who often feel guilty for being the ones that survived.
Right.
Don't they?
Right.
And so their guilt is a piece of this somewhere in there, and guilt is very powerful. So I'm just trying to establish that too, because I think that'll come up and come with some of these other stories. But all right, so what happened then? You induce an after-death communication. What happens?
Well, as I was working with Gary, and his sadness became real intense, and then I continued to eye move him, and his sadness started to come down. And when it did, I this time, as I said, I was, you know, attempting to induce one of these experiences. It was the first time, and I asked Gary to then close. I gave him another set of eye movement and asked him to close his eyes and just go with whatever happens. And when he closed his eyes, he saw his daughter sitting in this beautiful field playing. And she looked up at him and smiled. And he opened his eyes and said, "That was really wonderful." He said he was sure that was the spirit of his daughter. And when she looked at him and smiled, he could feel her love for him. And he felt wonderful about that. But then a sad look came over his face. And I said, "You know, what is it? What's the problem?" And he said, "You know, it was nice to see her again, but that just made me miss her all over again." And I, you know, I wish I could be with her, but I can't. And so I had him hold that thought in mind, and I gave him another set of eye movement. This time, he went back to the same field, and his daughter was there, only this time his daughter spoke, and she said, "I'm still with you, Daddy." And when he opened his eyes, the feeling that he, you know, continued to miss her was gone, because when she said that, he really felt like she was with him. And then he said, you know, that was really remarkable. He said, when she was alive, she couldn't speak.
And this was, again, speaks to the idea that in death, somehow these people have become sort of perfect and whole, and at a place where if they were seniors, they suddenly go back 20 years and they look younger and healthier and more vibrant. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask you then, before we take some calls from some of the people with whom you've worked, I want to ask you for patterns. What do you see as being consistently, Patty, you mentioned she was in a field of flowers, or, you know, the previous person and the things that they had said, and what are the consistent things that keep popping up with this? And as a scientist inducing these after-death communications, what do you suspect? What do you wonder about in the consistencies or the inconsistencies of these experiences? Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Induced after-death communications, Dr. Alan Bodkin. So one of the ones that stuck out with me in your book brings me back to this idea about patterns, too, and that's the story of Victor, who is missing his friend Charlie, whom he had seen. The last time he had seen Charlie, he had been brutally killed in a firefight. And I think those kind of images are pretty common. I know a lot of World War II veterans we'll speak about that, not often. I mean, they don't jump up and talk about it, but, you know, if push comes to shove, they'll talk about their having witnessed their best friend who had been with them through so much already and, you know, rolling the guy's body over and suddenly their face is missing. Yeah. And they just, it just is such a horrible image, and they can't, then they were on the battlefield, you know, shrieking in terror as they were looking at it. And even though they survived, they were never able to overcome that.
Right.
But talk a little bit about Victor's, because okay. Victor had an experience where he got to talk to Charlie, his buddy in the Korean War again.
Right. As a matter of fact, Victor was a Korean vet, if I remember right. I'm pretty sure.
And he was.
They were in this really bad firefight in Korea, and his best buddy Charlie was some small distance from him. But in the firefight, Charlie was hit and killed. And after the fight was over, he went over and saw his buddy all bloodied and mangled, you know, from being hit. And Charlie was dead. But that was the cause of some really profound grief and traumatic images for Victor for many, many years. He described this image coming up nearly daily, you know, since the Korean War. So, but anyway, in the ADC, he saw Charlie smiling and happy and looking whole again without his wounds. And if I remember right, Charlie said something like, you know, everything's okay. I'm okay and everything's okay. And after the experience, Victor said, you know, when he said that, when he said, I'm okay and everything's okay, I really felt like everything was okay.
Right.
And this image of Charlie looking healthy and happy and peaceful and actually replaced this bloody image that he had carried around in his head for many, many years. And so that's one of the real powerful aspects of induced after-death communication, is that because when people have the experience, the positive image in many, many cases, in fact, an overwhelming majority of cases, actually replaces the negative image. Charlie even had a hard time after the session. He had a hard time even bringing up the image.
Victor did.
It seems far away and faded and much less clear.
So what patterns do you see then? It seems like everybody says, I'm okay. Have you ever had an after-death communication induced where somebody says to the person who is trying to reconcile with these nightmarish images or with this profound grief experience, who's ever been told by the other person, I'm not okay. I'm in hell. Come and get me. I'm dying in here.
No, we've never had anybody report that kind of hellish experience. Generally, you know, probably, as you say, the most consistent thing that comes through in an ADC, the simplest and most frequent, is a smiling face, a smiling, healthy, happy face, and the message, I'm okay. You know, don't worry about me, that kind of thing. However, it's interesting that we have also induced ADCs with deceased people who, by all societal standards, were very bad people in life. And sometimes we have ADC'd, you know, abusive and cruel fathers and so on. And it's interesting that these kind of people in ADCs always come across as apologetic, wanting to fix the harm they caused in survivors, taking full responsibility for their actions. And I think the reason for that, which gets into a larger and I think very important issue, which is the similarity between induced after-death communications and near-death experiences. Because in one component of the near-death experience is something called the life review. And when a person near death experiences a life review, they experience either all moments in their life or key moments in their life in a brief moment. And in this life review, they re-experience the feelings they had in different situations in life. But more than that, they also experience the feelings they caused in other people at the time. So if someone was mean and cruel to another person, at the time, it might not mean anything to that mean and cruel person. But in the life review, they feel the pain they caused in other people. And people have had near-death experiences and have come back, and if they've had a life review as part of their near-death experience, these people are absolutely changed.
They are changed. But how much of that is... To a certain point, how much of that can we just write down to wishful thinking? That these are, you know, Victor needs to know that Charlie's okay so that he can stop feeling guilty about being the one that survived and stop feeling so bad about the pain and anguish that Charlie experienced on the battlefield. Or Sam and Lee, or the other example, and his daughter, who, you know, he always wanted the best for and always wanted to have a conversation with. How come, where do we look at, how do we see those, how do we separate out the hope for something and the result of something?
Well, it's generally consistent in induced after-death communications that the content of the experience generally comes as very surprising to the experiencer. As a matter of fact, I don't think wishful thinking can account for this, because many times people have experiences that they do not at all anticipate or wish for, and sometimes they have an experience that goes against what they might have wished for.
Give us an example of that.
Well, it's kind of interesting. This is one interesting case that just immediately pops into my mind. I was working with a veteran who lost somebody he knew in Vietnam in a rocket attack, and he went running into the barracks that were hit, and he held this guy in his arms as he died. Now, this was a traumatic experience for him, and that image kept coming back to him. But and we did an ADC, which seemed to resolve his grief and trauma about this incident. But then he asked if he could go back and get this and ask this guy what his name is. And and these two people weren't that close in Vietnam, but in veterans get compensated for their traumas, and they get service connected ratings, and you know, and they get monthly paychecks, you know, based on the traumas they went through and how they have disturbed their lives and so on.
Right.
But anyway, he wanted to get this guy's name, not because it was a heartfelt thing that he needed or wished or wanted. It was because he wanted this guy's name to substantiate his trauma in his paperwork.
And so he was just doing his as kind of a pro forma thing for something he had to turn into the VA.
Yeah. So anyway, when I took him back to the experience, the guy, the deceased person, said, "Why do you want to know my name now? You didn't want to know it back then." And he opened his eyes and he was kind of startled. And he said, "The guy saw right through me." And I go, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "He knew I was insincere about wanting to, you know, for my motivation for wanting to get his name."
Part of me thinks that's totally amazing, and I hear that and I go, "Wow." The other part of me says, I wonder whether that's like in any kind of dream where you challenge yourself, you call yourself on your own BS in your own dream. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, that could be. But we have other cases that argue against the idea that these are kind of made up. I've had cases where people didn't even understand the message from the deceased.
Now, that's interesting.
Had to go back and ask for clarification. I had one person who did an ADC with his father, and after we had done the usual ADC and he got the usual result, he said, "You know, my father, when he was alive, he always gave me good advice. Can I go back and ask him for advice on what to do with my life now?" And I said, "Sure," and I induced the experience again. And when he opened his eyes, he looked a little befuddled, and he said, "My father told me to use my tools." And he said, "My toolbox has been in the back of my garage for 30 years, you know, and I haven't kept up on, you know, the latest developments. You know, why would he tell me to use my tools? I don't understand that. It seems like bad advice to me." And I said, "Well, why don't you go back and ask him to clarify?" So I took him back to the experience. And then his father explained to him that he didn't mean those tools. He meant the tools that he is learning in therapy.
Huh. So his dad was being figurative from the grave.
Right.
And so going back, you can continue to induce this experience at will. Are there times when you cannot induce an after-death communication?
There. Once it gets rolling, once it starts to happen, you can continue to go back to it so you can get all the issues resolved, which is the advantage of the induced after-death communication over the spontaneous ones that just pop up. You know, 20% of the population, 1 out of 5 people, have had after-death communication spontaneously. And the thinking in the field is that, or so far, has been that these experiences can only happen spontaneously. So these experiences are not at all new, and a lot of people are having them. They've been around for a long time. The only thing new is with what I'm doing is inducing them on purpose. But the advantage is you can keep going back to the experience until all issues get resolved.
Well, it seems that some of those, and we'll have to leave this here for the moment, some of that 20%, I mean, maybe even a majority of it, at least in the conversations we've had on Coast to Coast, happen in a dream state. And what's different about the induced after-death communication is this is not when someone's asleep. This is not hypnosis. But we'll pick it up here in just a moment with Tom, one of the people who has had NADC. Coming up next on C2C, this is IP. Dr. Alan Botkin and his associates have now done over 3,000 cases of induced after-death communications in which people are relieved of their grief and their pain over the loss of a loved one through a kind of what they call an EMDR, an eye movement desensitization, and reassignment. Dr. Botkin, what was the R standing for again?
Reprocessing.
Reprocessing. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And through this EMDR program have been able to move the patient, was originally done as sort of an accident, but now can be done at will, into an after-death communication with a very specific person. Now, I read the story earlier of Betty, I think it was, who had missed Hank. And when she brought up Hank in the after-death communication, along came Hank's sister, too, whom Betty had only met once at a family reunion.
Right. I remember.
How often does that happen?
It occurs. It's not at all rare, and it's fairly frequent that when you induce one family member, sometimes you get other deceased family members showing up as well.
Now, have you ever induced somebody to try to get a family member and then been unable to get that person at all?
No.
Okay. What does that tell you then about how, what's the mechanism for this? Before we go to Tom, before we talk about Tom's experience, what can happen that you can conjure or the experience can recall a particular person from the afterlife?
Well, I don't see it as necessarily conjuring or, a particular person as much as I see it as what the procedure does is it sort of gets a person in a state where the door is open, where the deceased person can then come through. Spontaneous after-death communications occur when people sort of least expect it, and when they occur during sleep, people might call them dreams, but most people who have ADCs during sleep say they're very different from dreams. They have a clarity and a message that's much more powerful than dreams, and it can be remembered for years afterwards and so on. I was unsure why it was that every time we did this procedure, we always got the person that was the subject of the grief.
Exactly.
And I think maybe one way of looking at this, if you believe that these are true after-death communications, that they're real spiritual experiences, what we're doing is putting out an invitation and then simply opening the door.
Okay.
And that person steps through it.
Before we go to Tom, tell us about Tom's experience.
Well,
as a doctor, as a physician working with Tom.
Tom is one of those guys who was absolutely remarkable to work with. First, he's a very brilliant guy. Had some special jobs that he did in Vietnam, and he's just a remarkable guy. The amount of trauma he had, and the degree of the traumas he had was very, very extensive. A lot of painful stuff that he was able to work through much of that in therapy. But I'm sure Tom can explain it much better than I.
We will. But Tom came to you through when you were still with the VA.
Correct.
Okay. Was he one of your early patients?
Sort of towards the beginning.
But you were already in a groove by this point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I was already in the groove, yeah.
All right. And so we'll pick it up with Tom himself. We'll ask what it was that was causing him such grief and anxiety over the loss of someone during the Vietnam War, and then what Tom experienced firsthand during his after-death communication induced by Dr. Alan Botkin, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So Tom and Dr. Alan Bodkin join us again on Coast to Coast AM to talk about Tom's firsthand experience. We'll get one or two of these, I think, coming up, and we'll also open up the phones in the next hour. So Tom, tell me about what happened to you in Vietnam and how long that experience had haunted you.
I spent three tours in Vietnam, the very beginning of the war, the middle of the war, and toward the end of the war. And I spent most of my time in the combat, in combat situations, and I had lots of remembrances of ugly things that I did and other people did to me. And
now, when you say you did, meaning things that we might think of, you know, as torture or trying to extract information or flagrant abuses of non-combatants? Can you be more specific?
Yeah. For the most part, I would say that the experiences that I had was going against our society, our moral society, in that I took lives. I aimed a gun, I pulled the trigger, and I wasted people. And that's a true term, wasting them.
But ordinarily, I mean, in a war situation, we would think that you would be comfortable with this if this were somebody who had a gun that was aiming at you.
You might think that, but it's not true.
Interesting.
It's not true. You never get really used to pulling that trigger. It's always a human being over on the other side. It's always a person with a life that you've taken. It's people with a billfold full of pictures and documents in his pockets from his,
sure,
from his family.
So, but in your case, and we're just trying to understand a little more,
yeah,
this was not like, this wasn't a me lie like experience that you were. Okay. So just even in seeing somebody at the end of your scope and knowing that when you pulled the trigger, they went down and they were never going to get up again, you carry that with you.
Absolutely.
Was there any one particular image?
Yeah, I call it a hallway. There's a door in my hallway. As I go down my hallway, there's other doors in the hallway, and I can open them up, and there's a box. The box is in there, and shelves. And each one of these have an experience. And none of them are good.
Hmm. How many do you have?
How many experiences?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But more
than
you... Never reached the end.
But I've gotten a lot of benefit and a lot of comfort from the rapid eye movement.
So tell us about then what happened after Dr. Bodkin went through that second procedure that induced an after-death communication. With whom did you speak?
You have to realize there was a number of these things, a large number of these happenings, the incidents. And I've tried before I got to Dr. Bodkin, I tried hypnotism. I tried religion. I tried all kinds of different ways to come to peace with myself, to forgive myself for what I had participated in and what I had done personally. And with Dr. Bodkin, the difference was in hypnotism. It took me a couple of years and never got anywhere. With Dr. Bodkin, it was a matter of being able to spend 25 minutes to 40 minutes. I saw the people. I talked to the people.
You spoke to them in English?
Yeah.
And they understood you in English?
Yes.
Did they speak to you back in English?
Yes.
And what would they have said to you?
They said it was okay, that it was war, and they understood, and they didn't hold it against me because the shoe could have been on the other foot. It could have been me as well as them. And where they were happy, they were confident that they were living well, and they were very happy. And that's what came across to me, was their happiness and their forgiveness.
How many had you had a chance to speak to?
Oh, I can't really tell you that the number. It's probably 30, 40.
Wow.
And that also includes my dad, my mother, and my brother. So it's not only the military experience, but it's also life experiences within a country here with our own families.
What did your family say to you?
My mother and my father told me that they were pleased with what I was doing. They're proud of me. And that they were fine and everything was great where they were. And they're going to be waiting for me. So I left that particular trauma feeling good, feeling really great, actually. And something I had been worried about for, a number of years. I puzzled over these things and all these other things popping up there, and all these ghosts showing up. I was putting them to rest, and I was happy with what the results were.
I bet you were. Let me ask you, do you really believe you spoke with the dead, as opposed to had a conversation with your own psyche, which was symbolized by the images that had been haunting you?
You know, I asked myself that for a while when I first started. I really doubted that what I was doing was valid. I really thought it was wishful thinking on my part.
Right.
But it wasn't. I found out later that these things came back to me, and they were very pleasant. They were very nice. And I was happy where the people were. So I stopped fighting myself with trying to decide what this was. I'm a mathematician, basically.
Right. So not given to flights of fancy like this.
No. It's either black or white. And,
right.
Numerical combinations and preciseness. But again, I can't tell you the results that it has had on me. I was very suicidal. I haven't had that thought for a long time.
And we're so glad of it. And I don't mean in any way to challenge that experience. And I completely accept your testimony.
No, I understand what you're asking, because everybody asked me the same question.
But what is it now? How have you changed then, do you think, personally? I mean, you're obviously still a mathematician, analytical by nature. But how have you changed after then coming to terms with the fact that you have had a true and honest after-death communication?
I am much more settled. I'm happy with myself, which I wasn't before. I don't blame myself for most of the things that I did. And I say most of them because I still have a little bit more work to go.
Right.
My family life is tremendous. It wasn't before. And like I say, I don't have any thoughts in my mind at all of doing harm to myself.
Now, were any of the things that were troubling you, were they related to your buddies who had not survived the war?
There's some of those.
Okay.
There's a combination. I'll tell you one example with the enemy, and that is that we shot and killed a number of North Vietnamese, and we buried them. And because our general, the brigade commander, didn't believe that there were North Vietnamese there, we had to dig them up and put them on planes, helicopters. And that bothered me, that part of it. Plus, I knew that I had killed several of them.
Right.
And we put them on helicopters, and they came back. And that always, I was saving them for a long time.
Because the bodies had already started to decompose?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of nasty.
Yeah.
And what happened was, during eye movement, I sat down with these people. They were alive. They're all alive. And now you have to understand that I don't speak Vietnamese with them, and they don't speak English with me, but we are able to talk mentally, not verbally.
Your volume went down just a little bit. If you could just speak up a little bit, Tom.
Oh, okay.
That's fine. So even though you don't speak each other's languages, you could communicate, and they were communicating to you, that was okay.
Yeah, can I just add something here?
Please go ahead, Dr.
Yeah, what Tom is describing is rather common with induced after death communication. It's not so much a communication with language. It's more of a communication with pure thought. So you can have a conversation with somebody who's Vietnamese, and you're not necessarily speaking a language as much as you are just transferring thoughts in a very clear manner.
So thank you. And released from guilt to a point, you say you still have a little more to work with there.
Not on that one.
Not on that one.
I talked to these people. They were like I said, I sat down with them and I apologized to them that not only did we kill them, but also we had to take all the possessions and the pictures and everything and
sure.
separate it. And all these things play a role. And they all told me it's okay. They understand. And again, they said they were happy where they were.
Do you feel bad for being such a good shot?
No, I feel very alive.
Yeah.
Being a good shot.
Yeah.
But, if I was a bad shot, I wouldn't be talking to you.
Yeah. But, I mean, I mean that as a sincere question. I mean, you were really good at it.
Yes.
And so you survived.
Yes.
And that's a hard... It sounds like a hard thing for you to take pride in.
I think I can answer the question you're asking me. I have a lot of guilt about being alive. I always think, why did they die? And why did my friends die?
Right.
And I'm alive. That's another aspect that I have to deal with. And it's easier now, but for many years it was, why me? Why did I survive?
What's your answer that you're intuiting from these after death communications on why you?
Well, I don't know. I can't answer that.
Have you ever asked anybody on the other side why you?
No, I haven't. That's a good question. But I
mean, if it's central to your guilt and to your pain, that seems like a fair question to ask. You've been honest with both your victims and, you know, your comrades in arms. Why not ask them that and just see what they say? Maybe the answer too will be something which will relieve you of that sense of, you know, that you were just the right guy in the right place, not for any particular grander reason. Maybe there is a grander reason why you.
I've tried to find that too.
Yeah.
I haven't thought it yet.
Thank you, Tom. You're an excellent example of this, and thank you for being really of sharing your candor on this subject. I know it's not easy for you, but thank you because you really helped explain it.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. And we're going to do a couple more. We'll do Yusuf coming up after the top of the hour. Okay, Dr. Bodkin?
Sounds good.
And we'll let you tell us a little bit about him, too, before we talk to yet another person who has gone through after-death communication induced by Dr. Alan Bodkin. That's the book. Induced After Death Communications, and we'll continue this conversation with all of us living and dead next on Coast to Coast AM.